Welcome to the second session of this morning's talk. I was asked to make a brief introduction on the subject of this session, on which we will have just one expositor, and that will give me a little time to expand a little bit on this introduction and just point a couple of issues that bother me, and issues that sometimes are not fully taken into account in discussing these issues. The first point that I want to make is the importance of the equivalence principle. The equivalence principle is not just part of GR, but it's at the heart of inertia. That's because operationally, if we want to look for an inertial frame, the only way we can do it is relying on the equivalence principle. Basically, when we look operationally for an inertial frame, the only thing we seem to be able to do, this, besides considering something like the frame of the rest stars, which we know doesn't exist, is to consider a couple of particles, throw them, adapt our motion so that we see these particles moving inertially, and then the law of inertia says all other particles in that frame will move inertially. That's the operational construction of an inertial frame. And of course, for that, we need free particles, but we know that we can turn off other interactions, electromagnetic interaction we can turn off by looking at particles that have no charge, nuclear forces we can turn off by making sure that our things are relatively far away, but we can never turn off gravity, at least not 100%. And therefore, the only way that this recipe is compatible with the fact that gravity exists and therefore free particles don't exist is the equivalence principle. So the equivalence principle is what makes operationally accessible inertial frames. So if we are going to violate the equivalence principle, we have to be very careful because all sorts of things are going to go wrong. Second, testing the equivalence principle we know has a long tradition. It was very important when gravity was described at the Newtonian level, and we know the efforts by Gauss and later by people that were instrumental in the development or in the as part of the motivation of the of general relativity, Ed Bosch experiments we all learn about, and the refinements of those done in the 50s by Dickey and company. And of course, since the fit for saga situation in the mid 80s, the tests have become remarkable. Basically, what one does is consider two objects and freely falling, made of different compositions, and one measures the difference relative differential acceleration for these objects. All these tests have been basically done with very standard matter, in the sense that these are stable chemical elements. We have much fewer tests with, for example, unstable particles or other elementary particles, although we have, one can extract indirect bounds from from the experiments done with stable elements. This is a graph produced by the group of Adelberger, telling us what are the bounds of possible, the strength of possible new forces that violate the equivalence principle with as a function of the effective length of this interaction. And we see that that there are regions at extremely short distances which are basically unexplored, while this region that was not explored 20 years ago or 30 years ago is now being rather well explored. Of course, we also should remember that there are various versions of the equivalence principle. At the theoretical level, when one starts thinking about the construction of general relativity. We all learn about the weak, the Einstein and the strong equivalence principle. But when we are going to start thinking about extending it to quantum systems, one has to be careful in exactly in which way one formulates it, because those descriptions are not enough. I'm going to mention to you or cite this recent analysis in which they consider at least four versions of the equivalence principle. One of the versions is saying is basically the universality of free fall of all test bodies. All test bodies fall with the same acceleration. And of course, you see that this is a problem when you want to go to quantum mechanics, because an object doesn't have a clearly well-defined acceleration, or it's difficult to know what we mean by that. Then another version is to say, well, an homogeneous gravitational field is equivalent to an accelerated frame. And that's fine, except that in reality, we never have an homogeneous gravitational field. Exactly how one extrapolates this to situations which are in which the gravitational field is not homogeneous, which are things that occur in real life, is not clear. And I'm talking here about operational definitions of the equivalence principle, the things that people that sit in the lab and can test. When you write a theory, you can, of course, say, well, the theory satisfies the equivalence principle if there is a metric and blah, blah, blah that couples to all objects. But what is very important is to have an operational definition, because that's the way we can really go and test it in the lab in a mostly theory-independent way. To deal with the inhomogeneities, one can express a version in which one says there is a universality of behavior of systems in small enough regions of space-times that is supposed to deal with the with this issue that in reality we never have homogeneous gravitational fields, but it's not clear exactly what do we mean by that in the context of a quantum world. And finally, this is a version that has this failure that I have just described. It's a theoretically described version of the universal of the equivalence principle. This, when we say it has universal couple to there is a minimal couple to matter fields to gravity. Gravity described in terms of some metric theory. It's nice and fine when you write a theory, but it's much more difficult to test when you do an experiment, to test it in a theory-independent way. In a sense, I wanted to note a couple of objections to all these ideas that occur even at the classical level. If you, one objection is called the Ohanian objection, which basically comes from the fact that none of these ideas seem to be, well, at least not the first three, seem to be valid if you consider things like a self-gravitating drop of liquid. If you consider a self-gravitating drop of liquid, the drop will not be spherically due to the tidal forces of gravity. And you expect that when you start making the drop smaller and smaller, if something like this was going to hold, the drop will become spherical as you make it smaller. But that's not the case. It's not the case because it's all, but when you're making it smaller, it's all self-gravitating force that is driving the particle, the drop to acquire a spherical form, is not able to overcome the tidal forces that are there. So the shape of the particle remains non-spherical even if you go to the limit in which the size goes to zero. So in that sense, these things cannot be valid. In the quantum context, things are even worse because, among other things, a quantum object is never exactly localized in any sense. Moreover, if one takes Schrodinger equation, the one that we saw derived this morning in the previous talk, in the context of gravity, we find an expression of this form where the mass does not drop from the equation. So it is something that has led some people to consider this as a violation of the equivalence principle, and that's because they have thought that the equivalence principle, they have thought this is the correct way to deal with the equivalence principle in the quantum context, and it's certainly not, simply because it's based on ideas that are classical. Anyway, this equation has now been tested with neutrons in the famous Kao experiments, and more recently in Grenoble. and refinements of that can be expected to come. The point that I want to emphasize is that we know that gravity must be an emergent phenomena. Gravity must be an emergent phenomena, even if we take a very a conservative point of view. Perhaps, as many people have suggested, there is some pre-metric structure, something that that has degrees of freedom that are described in terms of something radically different. And from there, we are supposed to recover, it's in some degree of approximation, the metric description of gravity. But when we take gravity, when we recognize that gravity must be quantum, at the quantum level, when we know it must be described by something else that is perhaps spin forms, perhaps strings, perhaps causal set, and probably something very different. But from those variables that are not metric characterization, we are supposed to recover the GR, and in particular the equivalence principle. It seems very hard to find a way to recover something like a precise version of the equivalence principle from something which is not an underlying metric structure. After all, Einstein was driven to consider space-time as a metric and describe it in terms of a metric precisely because he wanted to ensure a precise version of the equivalence principle. And the point in the quantum world is that quantum objects are never point-like, and therefore they can it's not clear in what sense we should consider that their description should be should lead to a characterization in terms of the characterization that is sensible at the GR level, in the sense that we know that the particle in GR is supposed to follow a geodesic, but we don't know what it means to assign a geodesic to a quantum object or something of that sort. Of course, we can do things that are approximated, but we cannot do anything that is precise. And in that sense, the precise nature, the precise validity of the equivalence principle is something that is very naturally questionable in the quantum context. In fact, it's not only questionable. Things are worse than one may have thought. For example, photons are not to violate the letter of the equivalence principle in the sense that they don't move on geodesics. In this paper of 1980s, Durbin and Hatherl have shown that the path of a photon is going to be affected by the curvature in a very non-minimal coupling time type of way. And this is understood, in a sense, as a result of the virtual pairs of electrons positrons that accompany the propagation of a photon. And due to this, in some sense, to this dressing of virtual pairs, the photon acquires a size of that order. And being of that size, it makes the object not point-like and sensitive, therefore, to curvature. And that connection to curvature makes it follow paths that are not geodesics. In fact, classically, Papapetro has shown that particles with spin do not move along geodesics. And of course, a sovereign fact for us is that we do not have any elementary particle that has no spin. And therefore, if even classically particles don't follow geodesics, particles with spin don't follow geodesics, how do we operationally state some version of the equivalence principle that we may hope to be exact? I don't think we can do this. Okay, so after throwing these ideas that perhaps we can discuss, we'll discuss them afterwards because my instructions were to give the floor now to the first talk, that is a talk about a proposal for improved test of the equivalence principle using satellites, if I understand correctly, and is motivated in part by the search for new fields coupling to matter. And a question that I would leave for the discussion session is how do we, in principle, can we in principle distinguish these novel couplings from real violations of the equivalence principle? So I leave you with the speaker for the first session. Oh, okay. No, you just need to change here to the... Ah, okay. I need to give you the mic, yes.
Is that working? I think so.
You have 15 minutes.
All right. This here is an artistic rendition of an experiment that has not yet flown. All right, the equivalence principle, I think we know most of these things. Einstein's happiest thought occurred to him in the patent office in 1907. Locally, gravitation equal to acceleration. I think I'm using version one of your list there. The idea that a freely falling test particle, its trajectory will be independent of things such as composition or internal structure. Gravitation being unique in this aspect was what led Einstein to general relativity. We test this by dropping different materials in the same field. And 400 years of testing have brought us a little bit better than the point shown here. Where's that hockey stick that you have?
Oh, yes, sorry.
We're actually up at the 10 to the minus 13 now. Galileo usually gets the credit, but this guy, Simon Stevin, a couple of decades before Galileo, was dropping balls out of a church tower in Delft.
Galileo never dropped anything.
Galileo may or may not have. I understand this is up for debate, whether he did or not. But he certainly rolled things down inclined planes, as shown in this fresco in an Italian church somewhere. He is, I think this is him here. So some of the people who pushed this further were Newton with the observation that moons and planets could serve as test bodies. Bessel, Ed Bosch with his torsion balance. These things have been noted already. So a space test, which is one of the things I'm interested in studying, could push this quite a bit further in one jump. What's of interest is this range here between 10 to the minus 13 and 10 to the minus 18. People not as familiar with this as you all are often say that 10 to the minus 13 is already very small. Why bother going any farther? And the main purpose of my talk is to try and convince you that this range is important, and to go from 10 to the minus 13 to 10 to the minus 18 is about as far as we really need to go. And I'm hoping you'll tell me whether this is right or wrong. I'm basically trying to bounce this idea off of people. Well, let's see what happens. A satellite test of the equivalence principle has been proposed since the 70s by people in Stanford. And the basic idea is that you're doing what Galileo may or may not have done, except you're doing it continuously in free fall around the Earth. So an animation looks something like this. These are gravitationally spherical test masses. They're belted cylinders, but to a high degree of accuracy, they're spheres. And they're falling with cylindrical symmetry, and they're made of different materials. And STEP would use several pairs of these things and change them in controlled ways to try and to see if the effect is real. So some of the main reasons why this gives you that precision of 10 to the minus 18 is that there's a long integration time. The signal is periodic, unlike just dropping something off of a tower. You're using the whole mass of the Earth to drive this thing, which gives you, I think, 2 to 3 orders of magnitude over the torsion balance. And you get another 2 to 3 orders of magnitude because you're in a very quiet environment. Using drag-free control, you can really push down the sources of noise. And this would inherit a lot of technologies from the Gravity Probe B mission, especially the SQUID readouts, but many others as well. Oops. Okay. This is a picture I like to show to people. This is not to scale. This is the theorist view here. But I see it this way, and maybe a lot of us do, that human progress rests on science and technology, which rests on physics. And for all of us in this room, we go down to the basement, and we work either here or here. And these are some of the ways that we test the basement of physics. But to go even deeper, you're testing not just the predictions of those theories, but the assumptions that go into them. And in the case of general relativity, general covariance, I think nobody's going to seriously question. But the equivalence principle, the physical foundation of GR, is the place where we all have questions. I'm not going to talk about the standard model today. This is another way that I like to look at this. So we all know about the inconsistency between general relativity and the standard model based on quantum field theory. Physics in crisis today, the incompatibility between those two things reminds some people, and gravity resting mostly on the EP, is reminiscent of the earlier situation a century ago when we had a different crisis where electromagnetism was incompatible with Newtonian mechanics. Electromagnetism resting on this pillar, constancy of the speed of light. I see a strong analogy between those two. And in the earlier case, this was resolved by this Michelson-Morley experiment, which definitively established that we had to deal with this. And the way through was a new theory, special relativity. So could it be that a similar thing is going to happen in the case of GR and quantum and the standard model? If this analogy would strictly hold, we would find no equivalence principle violation at any level. And what would that force us to? I think that's as interesting as finding EP violation. Maybe more interesting. The big question, what to drop? Nowadays we would love to drop all of these kinds of things instead of, I understand that Galileo, if he did it, dropped musket balls and cannonballs, which I think were lead and iron, I think. This was reported by his students, so he never claimed to do it. But anyway, imagine if we could drop some of these things. Who can say what would happen? The people who look into this, and I'm guided a lot by Thibaut Damour and some of his colleagues, claim to tell us that the kinds of things that you look for would be differences in, you're essentially looking for the biggest possible spread in the phase space of the standard model. And three parameters that have been singled out in the past have been the total baryon charge, the neutron-proton difference, and the electrostatic binding energy. And recently, there's also a focus on the nuclear binding energy. So this will become a bigger picture. But if you plot some basic compounds and the elements of the periodic table on this diagram, you see quite a big spread. And since we really have no strong guidance from theory, no unanimous guidance, the best thing is to pick things that are as far apart as possible and to drop as many of them as possible. The baseline, the current baseline for the satellite test of the equivalence principle is a platinum iridium compound, niobium, and beryllium. So there's the theory, there's what you'd like to drop, and there's also practical constraints like what you can machine and what's stable and what's allowed by the government, so forth. Okay, why some people see this as a probe of quantum gravity? This is not a very rigorous argument, but more of an analogy. So whenever you try to go beyond the classical theory, you're going to have terms that go like the characteristic energy scale over the quantum gravity scale. And if you just stick in the linear regime there, you might guess that the characteristic energy scale might be anywhere from a Higgs mass to, let's say, a nucleon mass. And the quantum gravity scale could be anywhere from the gut scale to the Planck scale. If you put those numbers in, it's kind of interesting that you get the same range of numbers here that you could get by going to space, but that you cannot get on Earth. There are a number of theories out there too, more specific theories. Some of them are brave enough to give predictions for where you might see EP violation. The numbers typically do come in this range as well. I think some of the people in this room have been the authors of some of these theories. I was strongly influenced by a paper of Sean Carroll's that I read, simulated by the discovery of dark energy, where he tried to take the most generic possible approach with a single new scalar field, a light scalar, allowed it to couple to standard model fields, and asked, what do current EP constraints say about those coupling strengths, beta? And he found that with the existing EP constraints of order 10 to the minus 12, the coupling strength already had to be very small, 10 to the minus 6. I think this is one of the reasons why people don't feel it's necessary to look farther. A lot depends on whether you see 10 to the minus 6 as unnaturally small or not. A space test would go 6 orders of magnitude more in delta A over A, which translates to 3 orders of magnitude in the coupling strengths. 5 minutes. So I see, so 10 to the minus 6, you can arrange that. 10 to the minus 9 starts to look unnatural. Especially, I think about this in terms of the strong CP problem, where a number like 10 to the minus 9 immediately makes people invent new kinds of dark matter. Ed Witten's quote would be surprising if a scalar like this existed and would not be detected if you could improve limits by 6 orders of magnitude. So in this sense, a null result can close the door in a way that wasn't available before. So in a nutshell, all or most approaches to quantum gravity involve new fields with non-universal couplings. The corresponding dimensionless coupling strengths beta translate directly into constraints on delta A over A. Below a certain point, which is somewhat to your taste, non-zero coupling strengths become unnatural. So in that sense, the null test allows you, turns this into a test of quantum gravity. Positive detection would be something else altogether. Okay, I don't even speak about that. So a space test offers the surest way to do this, partly because of the sensitivity, but also because you can drop a diverse set of things. So a test like this is complementary to accelerators and to dark energy telescopes. I think it should be seen as complementary. Well, on the one hand, we have the small-scale tests, the large-scale tests, and the intermediate gravitational tests. So where one could find indirect evidence for the new fields via their missing energy signatures, and where a telescope like WFIRST could find direct evidence for a light scalar via a time-changing equation of state, this one would tell you how the new fields interact with everything else. I'm going to stop there and just, if there are questions, I have a few more slides I could talk about, but let's see if you have any questions.
Okay, so we have about 7 minutes to discuss some questions about this.
As raised by Daniel, the issue is, what do you mean by an equivalence principle test for particle physics? Because, as you pointed out, they're not quite particles. They spin, except maybe if they spin zero. Another issue is, the Irish physicist Singh was a long time critic.
I know.
People may have forgotten this. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues, of course, is that for the inverse experiment and your experiment, you have a uniform gravitational field. And he criticized this as making a fundamental interpretation of the equivalence principle, not mainly.
Yeah, he said that the equivalence principle was like a midwife to GR that should now be buried with appropriate honors. Buried with all appropriate honors, if you look in the preface of his book. But I don't really know how to address that except to say I think that's not a majority view.
Can you repeat the problem or the question? We can hear.
I think John is more or less rephrasing what was said earlier about issues of tidal forces and whether the EP even can be defined in a consistent, yeah, self-consistent way. I think it can, and I guess this is almost a philosophical debate. I suppose I'm primarily interested in if there are these effects, let's look for them, is how I see it.
But I don't agree with you that this philosophical issue, because if it was possible to construct, you know, tidal forces that would be big in the context of the size of the wave function of some particular setup, it would be extremely interesting to test, and you would be testing something different from what you are testing.
Yeah.
You are testing, in some sense, the existence of these universally free-falling frames. So you are showing us that, and it's important, I'm not saying it's not important, you are showing us that free-falling frames are really obtained by following the prescription of letting yourself fall.
Yeah.
Right? But of course, it would be even more interesting if you could say, well, I'm free-falling, but it's not really free-falling because there are still tidal forces here, and I'm going to look for effects, for example, like the ones predicted by Harman. About the photon not following geodesics.
So.
Yes.
So if I understand properly, your type of experiment will rule out, for instance, the existence of a dilaton.
Yes, I see this as a potential test of string theory.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that it's not widely widely advertised as such.
So why not? I mean, if you're really ruling out the existence of a dilaton, that has, you know.
Okay, so what I was hoping was more feedback from you, the experts on this. So when I have talked to people about dilatons and so forth, the usual argument is you get these observable EP violations for light scalars, but that scalars in the context of string theory generically acquire these large masses, I guess, by renormalization effects or things like that. But that raises different problems, and I don't see why that should prevent you from looking for this. But if somebody knows more, is that a strong enough argument that we shouldn't even look for these effects? I don't think so.
I don't think so. And even if they are suppressed by the, you know, distance, perhaps making tests at short distances.
Yes.
You know, now we are able to test gravity at very, very short distances. This is going to be very very interesting. Of course, you are going to be sensitive to long distances, but even perhaps with the technology, satellite technology, you perhaps could test things at short distances, putting even your gravitational source in the satellite, not just the test object, but even the gravitational source. Sphere of iron producing attraction and seeing how things fall there.
Yes.
It's only a very small question. When you,
those are the worst.
No. I mean something which I don't understand. Like when we talk about the equivalence principle for atoms, then we, if you think as an atom as a round system, then we also consider the internal energy of the components. So the internal energy somehow has to fill this equivalence principle.
Right.
And the thermal energy.
Right.
So, for example, can you test if there is a dependence of the with the temperature, which is can be traced as a changing of the internal energy? I would like to know whether it's possible to test the equivalence principle for the internal energy of the atom.
I think so. For example, if you consider dropping iron versus hydrogen, right? I mean, one having a completely different internal structure with a different binding energy. If you drop those two and find a difference, you may be finding that binding energy falls at a different acceleration from mass energy.
I would like to reply to your question.
It was also a question for you, but we could not.
Can we test the equivalence principle for the binding energy of atoms? So the binding energy of nuclei is very high, and this features very strongly in tests of the equivalence principle. And one of the slides that I had to skip was, if you model the contribution of this binding energy to the sensitivity of the test to the parameters of the SME, it turns out you get a factor of 10 and possibly even 100 or 1,000 higher sensitivity to these terms. But it is very hard to model because nuclear models are very hard to calculate or very inaccurate or both. So what we've done is a very basic model, which has an error bar of about 30% in the binding energy. And unfortunately, this translates into an error bar by a factor of 100 or so in the limits. The limits I've shown are conservative ones at the 95% confidence interval. But if somebody's able to do a better job on the modeling, he might get limits that are 10 or 100 times better. So this principle
is possible.
And has already been done. The tough part here is the modeling of the nucleus.
Right.
We've actually talked to them, and they are not surprised about the large error bar.
And Holger, up to date, the atom interferometry experiments are always using isotopes of the same atom, right? But in
That's
the future,
right.
I think you have written that it may be possible to use entirely different atoms, which would be a huge advance, right?
Yes and no. So we've modeled, so in a very simple model, which neglects most of the nuclear energy contributions, we have a chart of all stable isotopes that live more than a few, stable as it lives more than 5 minutes or something. And you can determine the sensitivity of a test involving nucleus one versus nucleus two to the various SMB parameters. And it turns out that hydrogen versus tritium is the best, but it's very hard to work with. Of the feasible ones, lithium 6 versus lithium 7 is almost as good as any of the two versus cesium or rubidium. But by using the same isotope, you cancel a lot of systematic effects. So it's a tough question. The theory comes in and says, what would you like to use? And then the experiment says, but we can use only these ones. That's why it's so good that we have interferometers, blocks, torsion balances. They are all able to work with different matter.
I have a question, which is more probably a personal confusion about what you're actually testing. Because before we saw a talk in which we were considering constraints to coefficient basically in the standard model extension. So we were basically testing the Einstein equivalent principle using the Wilcome nomenclature. So The Einstein equivalence principle for me is universality of free fall, local Lorentz invariance, and local position invariance of non-gravitational experiments.
Yes.
So in your case, I don't understand if instead I should think of your test as a test of the weak equivalence principle in the sense of just universality of free fall. So the two things are not completely equivalent, because from this point of view, testing the weak equivalence principle, for example, is not able to discriminate between a scalar tensor theory of gravity or GR. Because Bransky theory do satisfy the weak equivalence principle. They do satisfy even the Einstein equivalence principle. What they don't satisfy is the strong equivalence principle in the sense that gravitational experiments are not the same, everywhere because Newton constant, if you like, is position dependent.
So I'm asking you,
are we agreeing on that? I mean, that there is a difference. These are universality of free fall tests.
Yes, I think so.
So,
and the second thing I would say is that the SME is one of the theories that makes specific predictions for a test like this. So it fits my general prescription of standard model plus a new field leads to weak equivalence principle violations or university of free fall.
So you are talking about this new version of
the SME,
SME,
yeah.
The one that includes gravity,
right?
Because otherwise there are no fields.
Right, so he basically adds some of, I believe, their vector fields onto the theory, and then these have a non-zero vacuum expectation value, which couples to the standard model fields and produces the violations, in a nutshell.
So I see. In your case, you are considering a theory that violates both the Einstein equivalence principle, obviously, because it's not as breaking, but also the weak equivalence principle.
Yeah, in the case of this SME, yes.
But note that in principle, it's not logically impossible to build a theory that violates only local Lorentz invariance without violating the Einstein, the weak equivalence principle.
I've never thought about that before, maybe so.
Yes.
Okay.
The SME contains all, so if you set some parameters zero but others not, you get purely flat space time effects or effects that can only be seen in curved space time model.
Well, the equivalence principle certainly is not. Does not imply GR, right? And we should test two things. One is how gravity affects matter, and the second one is how matter affects gravity, which is
but
more.
For example, you're suggesting to include the tidal forces. That I think would select, for example, gravitational theory, because the way the tidal forces enter in affecting the motion of the free particle, that would be definitely. We know that, for example, the set filter action, when you deal it, allows or not to rescale the metric so that self-gravitating particle follow geodesics in GR, but that is not generically true.
Yeah, no,
and then there is the issue that's been, as you say.
Generically, it will not follow
geodesics. With your those effects would actually start discriminating gravity theory.
That would be very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Improving those tests as well. So perhaps we are running out of time, so I will recommend for the next version of this conference to have more time for discussion, because as you see, there are the discussions always end before, the time always ends before the discussions. So, I'm supposed to give a second introduction now.